Today, David Cameron warned against a lobbying scandal. So how did he end up at the centre of one? In 2010, the then leader of the Conservative Party, David Cameron, made this speech.
It's the next big scandal waiting to happen. It's an issue that, frankly, crosses party lines and has tainted our politics for too long. It's an issue that exposes the far too cosy relationship between politics, government, business and money. I'm talking about lobbying, and we all know how it works. The lunches, the hospitality, the quiet word in the ear, the ex-ministers and ex-advisors for hire, helping big businesses find the right way to get its way.
11 years on, and David Cameron has found himself, via a quiet drink, some emails and friendly text messages, at the heart of a lobbying scandal of his own making. His work for the troubled financing firm Greensill Capital will now be investigated by a government review. But this story goes further than just the former Prime Minister. This week, it was revealed that the Cabinet Office approved one of Britain's most senior civil servants to work at Greensill while he was still employed in Westminster. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, what David Cameron's lobbying scandal tells us about money, power and influence in UK politics. Cleena McCourtough, you're The Guardian's banking correspondent. And I think to understand this story, we need to start by talking about the company at the centre of it, Greensill. Who are they and what do they do?
So Greensill Capital is named after its founder, Lex Greensill. He's a 44-year-old Australian, came from a farming family.
We started very small. We connected a handful of farmers in country Australia to the capital markets.
And he went into banking later on and went into supply chain finance at Morgan Stanley and Citibank before launching his own firm, Greensill, which effectively made him a billionaire.
It's been a tremendous ride, but I should say that it's been a ride that for me has been a 20-year journey as opposed to a kind of an overnight one.
So Greensill Capital was one of the largest lenders of supply chain finance.
Something that's been around since, well, the beginning of trade. Greensill just made it sound much more cutting edge than it really is.
It acted as a middleman, you know, offering suppliers an advance on invoices for a fee and then collecting that money directly from the business customers who owed them cash at a later date.
The company has now provided funding of over $163 billion during 2020 on behalf of more than 10 million customers in 175 countries. It's a remarkable story.
Right, so if I'm Greensill and you're a supplier that is waiting weeks to be paid by a customer, I step in and give you the money up front and then take the payment from that customer later. How does Greensill actually make money from this process?
So it gets the fee from the supplier, so the person or business who is getting the money up front. And one of the other ways, besides fees, they made money by packaging loans and selling them off to third-party banks and investment funds, including at Credit Suisse. So that's how they made money without taking deposits, as, say, a traditional bank does.
Who were Greensill's clients?
So they had a number of arrangements with blue chip companies. I think Vodafone and AstraZeneca previously, for example, are cited as some of the customers, I think even in David Cameron's statement. And Sanjeev Gupta, the metals magnate who owns GFG Alliance, which is the owner of the UK's third largest steel producer, Liberty Steel, was one of the largest.
Gupta's empire employs 5,000 people in the UK, many in northern Redwall towns where job prospects are slim without him. His empire was grown on the back of an aggressive acquisition spree funded by Lex Greensill, whose startup using supply chain finance had grand ambitions.
And were Greensill a respected company? Were they viewed as a successful business?
I think they were. I mean, how could you not? You have a former prime minister as a senior advisor to your board, and you are as of late 2020, going to investors and saying, look, we're a $7 billion business and we want to float on the public stock exchange.
But despite all of that, on the 8th of March this year...
Why is the collapse of Greensill dominating headlines from here to London?
Greensill filed for administration.
A spectacular fall from grace for Greensill. Many businesses in many territories have been exposed.
Why? What had gone wrong?
So that system of selling off loans to investors was key to the way Greensill operated. And once it had insurers who guaranteed those payouts pulling back, saying, A, they had potentially concerns about Greensill's management and a growing pile of debts issued to GFG Alliance, which owns Liberty Steel, it all started falling apart very quickly.
But what's brought Greensill unstuck is not the financing of small business payments, but some huge loans he's made to big businesses.
As you say, Liberty Steel, the third largest steel manufacturer in the UK, which employs thousands of people in this country, was backed by Greensill. What has this collapse meant for them?
So it has definitely caused some concerns in the British steel industry. I mean, there's 5,000 people employed by GFG Alliance, the parent company here in the UK. I think about 3,000 of those are directly with Liberty Steel. As far as we're aware, Sanjeev Gupta, the owner, has not been able to secure alternative financing. And so, you know, there are questions about how far the government is going to go in order to guarantee that those jobs are secured, even if GFG Alliance and Liberty Steel go into administration themselves.
Okay, so we have Greensill's collapse, which is having ramifications for companies actually all over the world right now. But let's go back a bit. Where does David Cameron come into all of this? When did he begin working for Greensill?
So he was hired as an advisor to the board of Greensill Capital in 2018, about 2 years after he stepped down as prime minister. And according to the 1,700-word statement that he released on Sunday, this role involved providing geopolitical advice to the leadership, helping to win new business, speaking for the company at conferences and events, and helping with plans for international expansion.
What was the arrangement here between David Cameron and Greensill? You know, what was he getting in return for this work?
So we have never been officially told what his remuneration was, what his pay was, and what his share options were. And we spent a lot of time last week going through the top company shareholder reports. And one thing that stuck out is that David Cameron's name was not there. What we understand is that his share options sit inside an employee benefit trust worth $30 million that was registered in Jersey. We don't know how much of that money was potentially promised to him, but we know that the value of those shares would have gone up exponentially if the company had floated on the stock exchange as planned. And the Times has reported that he told friends he was in line for a $60 million windfall if the company successfully floated. You know, Cameron has admitted he was paid partly in the form of share options, but he says it's, you know, nowhere near the amount speculated in the press, but, you know, he still hasn't confirmed the amount.
Just to be clear then, in taking on this role and working for Greensill, David Cameron wasn't breaching any rules, right?
No. As far as we're aware, he has not breached any rules. There was a short-lived investigation into whether he properly registered his lobbying efforts, but because he was an employee and not a third-party consultant, he was cleared of that investigation, I think, within days.
This has all blown up for David Cameron, and that is because of revelations that have emerged over the past couple of weeks, which show what he was trying to do for Greensill. Now, this is quite complicated, but as I understand it, he was hoping to secure access to a government loan scheme. Can you explain what that scheme was and why he wanted access to it?
Yeah, so you have to imagine, you know, middle of March.
So the goal of our economic strategy is to provide a bridge over what will be a sharp and significant crisis.
The government is scrambling to figure out how it's going to get money to businesses.
Supporting viable businesses to stay afloat and protecting the incomes of the most vulnerable.
And the first way they plan to do this is through commercial banks. And so they set up, you know, things like what was the original coronavirus business interruption loan scheme was the COVID Corporate Financing Facility, or CCFF, which was, you know, cheap, 100% government-backed emergency loans that were intended to give money directly to blue-chip businesses deemed crucial to the UK economy. So this was being distributed directly through the Bank of England and not through commercial banks like, say, Barclays, HSBC, et cetera, who were then expected to pass loans onto smaller businesses. So this was let's get money directly to large businesses through the Bank of England. And that is what David Cameron thought Greensill should have access to, not as a borrower, not saying, you know, Greensill Capital needs a cash injection, but to pass money on to other businesses, to its borrowers, say like Liberty Steel, which was not part of the rules and would have involved bending the mandate.
Right. So Greensill could have got involved with the way that they work by providing money up front to businesses that needed it quickly through a taxpayer-funded loan scheme.
Yes, but the CCFF, which Cameron seemed insistent that they should be part of, was just not appropriate. Greensill as a lender did not qualify for that scheme.
Did the Treasury want Greensill to have access to this loan scheme?
There seemed to have been some pushback, and based on text messages that have been reported by the Sunday Times. I mean, David Cameron seemed to be doing everything he could. He was sending text messages and emails to the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak.
In a highly unusual move, the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has made public two text messages he sent to David Cameron last year. Mr. Cameron had tried unsuccessfully to ask for help for the finance company where he was working as an advisor.
And suggested that it would have been nuts to exclude Greensill, which would have helped expedite the distribution of loans to businesses across the UK. And we've since found out that he also contacted two junior ministers, senior civil servants, and a number 10 special advisor. There were some suggestions that, you know, they were checking it out and doing what they could. But ultimately, he was rebuffed and told, no, sorry, we're not going to be allowing you access to this scheme.
The reply on April the 23rd rejects Mr. Cameron's proposal and goes on to say, I have pushed the team to explore an alternative with the bank that might work. No guarantees, but the bank are currently looking at it and Charles should be in touch. Best, Rishi.
He was not able to get Greensill access to the CCFF, but Greensill was subsequently accredited to provide loans through CL bills. So that's the Coronavirus Large Business Interruption Loan Scheme. Always a handful.
Catchy.
Yeah. We don't know, though, whether his lobbying led to that accreditation. There were a number of other non-bank lenders also accredited to emergency loan programs. But, you know, it was the second largest scheme. And reports suggest Greensill was able to extend about £400 million worth of loans to GFG Alliance as a result.
Greensill then may have lost out on that first loan scheme, but David Cameron also helped them to secure work with the NHS at the start of the pandemic, didn't he?
Yeah, so we learned in the past couple of days in the Sunday Times that David Cameron had a private drink meeting with Health Secretary Matt Hancock. He also took along Greensill founder Lex Greensill. And this was in October 2019. And he was promoting Greensill's wage advance program called Earned.
Our business is one where we pay people and businesses faster. And recently we launched an app called Earned, which allows employees to get paid every day if they wish, instead of waiting to the end of the month.
So, you know, you work a day rather than waiting a week or two for a payday. You say, look, I've worked my 8 hours, put that directly into my account.
In a way, Ian, it's our free cup of tea.
there are many companies that do this, and they were offering it originally to the NHS free of charge, neither charge to the employer, in this case the NHS, or the staff. As far as we understand it, Hancock said, said you need to go directly to the NHS for any of these discussions. And they did end up getting a number of contracts and agreements with individual NHS trusts throughout 2020.
I mean, if they weren't charging the NHS to pay the advances on those wages, why was Greensill interested in this contract? You know, what was in it for them?
So my sense is it's a reputation boost. You know, you already have a former UK Prime Minister serving as a special advisor to your board. As you're approaching investors, what could potentially look better than you working with one of the most reputable health organizations in the world? If you're working with NHS trusts, you know, they may not be earning any money from that directly, but there surely is a financial payoff long term.
Rajiv Sayal, you cover Whitehall for The Guardian and have been following this story as it's been gathering momentum over the past few weeks.
A former prime minister under fire.
We've seen some terrible examples during this crisis of cronyism, and the text messages that we've seen this evening raise far more questions about whether he's acted properly.
David Cameron has said nothing in the last 3 weeks, holed up at his Oxfordshire home as questions mount.
And on Sunday night, David Cameron was forced to finally issue a 1,700-word statement. What did he say in it?
He admitted for the first time that perhaps it would have been better for him to have gone through formal processes instead of using the mobile phone numbers of individuals that he knew in and around government, including the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and that he did say that he should have done so. But he, at the same time, he did not admit that he had done anything wrong. He did not apologise. And his statement left an awful lot of unanswered questions, not just for him, but also for the government.
I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, first of all, it was very strange timing, given that parties weren't releasing statements due to the death of Prince Philip. Also produced an awful lot of excuses for what Cameron had done and didn't really acknowledge the fact that he had been trying to ultimately profit by seeking large government contracts through close contacts.
David Cameron said in that statement, Rajiv, that he hasn't broken any rules. Is that true?
It does seem to be true that David Cameron has not broken any of the lobbying rules. And he should know, because he set up the Register for Lobbyists and set up the post of Registrar for Lobbyists in the mid-2000s. So he was probably very well aware that he was not in breach of any rules, because he helped to write them.
Have we heard politicians in the past week calling for rules on lobbying to be tightened again?
We have, and unfortunately we are stuck in a cycle, and that cycle is this, which is that a party in opposition argues for tightening of the regulations around lobbying. They get into power and then they realise that, A, they do need to talk to people outside of government in order to get ideas and also to find ways of working and implementing policies. And they don't always want to reveal who they're talking to. So once you start to draw up new rules, which allows other people access to, and journalists, for example, access to exactly who you're talking to, parties in power really don't want all that to come out. That's exactly what happened with Cameron. He made his speech about lobbying being the next scandal when he was in opposition. But when he got into power, he set up a bit of a lame duck. But it also happened with the Labour Party.
I'll be talking to Tony Blair in his first interview since the storm broke over tobacco advertising and Formula One.
Tony Blair, when he was in opposition, claimed that he was going to eradicate the sleaze of the Tory party when he got into power. But if you remember, Tony Blair got into power and was immediately caught in an enormous lobbying scandal.
The allegations arose after a decision by the government to exempt motor racing from a tobacco sponsorship ban. It then emerged that the head of the Formula One had given Labour £1 million.
Well, how has the government responded to all of this in the past week?
Well, the government has, under some fantastic reporting by the FT and Sunday Times and others, had launched an inquiry, and Boris Johnson announced this late last week. The terms of that inquiry are currently being debated, and I think you'll find that as the terms are examined over the next few days, there will be more and more critics of the way in which the government has set up that inquiry. It's not just the fact that they have set up an inquiry with a vague remit. They have also put in charge of that inquiry a solicitor who is already an advisor to the government's business department.
I've asked Nigel Boardman to have a look at this whole issue of supply chain finance and given him, you know, pretty much carte blanche to ask anybody whatever he needs to find out.
There are some concerns that Nigel Boardman, who is going to lead the independent review, may not be entirely separate from the issues, given that he is a non-executive director at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy.
How much do you think then this inquiry can actually achieve?
He could turn around and turn it into a highly explosive inquiry. He could open it up and examine what ministers have done. But that's not what the actual three-paragraph remit that's been released by the Cabinet Office says.
Rajiv, how damaging is this for Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak and the government?
It's difficult to say, because Boris Johnson has proved himself to be one of those Teflon politicians that has managed to take Britain out of the EU when no one thought it could be done. He has also managed to do it whilst riding high in the polls. He's also managed to get through a pandemic in which Britain had one of the worst death rates in the world, and he's riding high in the polls. So he may get away with it. At the moment, it doesn't seem to be damaging.
Mr. Speaker, this is a government and a party that has been consistently tough on lobbying, and indeed we introduced legislation saying that there should be no taxpayer-funded lobbying, that quangos should not be used to get involved with lobbying.
Coming up, Labour lost a vote yesterday on a full parliamentary inquiry into lobbying. So will the system ever really change? Is the problem here, Rajiv, that there is no appetite within Westminster to actually reform lobbying? You know, we're talking about David Cameron, who himself said before he was Prime Minister that we needed reforms to stop the next big scandal happening. And here he is at the centre of the next big scandal. You know, do you think anything will actually change? And what needs to change, do you think?
Well, I mean, we are caught in a situation where political parties feel as if once they get into power, they really don't want too much scrutiny, and they want to be able to work closely with the private sector. They want expertise and people from the outside who will make government work better. And that all means that they don't want to be scrutinised too much, and they want to be able to bring people in when they want them. And really, they don't want the public to know too much about it. So from that point of view, I could see this carrying on for some time, and us not really seeing major reforms.
Kalina, I think for a lot of people, all of this will seem like a very complex Westminster issue. Why does this matter?
I think there's a couple things. I mean, there's the ethics of the whole matter, which, you know, people could say, well, you know, how bad is this really? Who really lost out? But there's questions about the on-the-ground impact. So, you know, you take the trail back a few steps and you remember that you have 5,000 jobs at GFG Alliance that are potentially at risk if Liberty Steel and its sister companies go bust in the UK. That is a lot of people at steel plants across the country, about 3,000 of them.
It's not what you do, it's who you are. I support Rotherham United. We're fighting relegation, but one victory, and that gives you hope. And this is what it is. It's a bit of hope for us. He's saying he's not going to close any plants, and we've all got to take his word for it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that nobody will lose their jobs.
And on top of that, you have hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of government-backed loans that will potentially fall on the taxpayer to foot. Currently, that government guarantee is suspended as part of the British Business Bank investigation into Greensill Capital. But if they find no wrongdoing, there is going to be a question about, yeah, who foots the bill.
Kalina, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Kalina McCourtoff and Rajiv Sayal. Both have reported brilliantly on this, along with colleagues from our Westminster team. Keep up with their work and the latest on this story at theguardian.com. Well, you can also go back and listen to an episode of Today in Focus Anushka made with Felicity Lawrence and David Pegg in December about government contracts being given to Conservative-linked firms during the pandemic. It's called The Rise of the Chemocracy. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atack, Alex Mislin and Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.